I'm speaking today with Hector Uribe, who is the Democratic candidate for Land Commissioner in Texas. Hector, the first question I'd like to ask is, why are you running for this office?
Well, and the first response I'm going to give you is because I was asked by the leadership of the Democratic Party to be a candidate. But setting that aside, there's some very good public policy reasons why I want to be the next Texas Land Commissioner. And I think I have three bones of contention with Jerry Patterson, our current Land Commissioner. Since 1972, let me summarize first. One has to do with the permanent school fund and the diminution of funds and the flow of money flowing into the permanent school fund. The other has to do with the state of our bays and estuaries. And three, there's one more issue that just completely went out of my mind, but I'll get to it. First, let me speak about, unless you want to interrupt at any particular time, the permanent school fund. As the land commissioner, it is the land commissioner's responsibility to be the steward of our state's land and natural resources. And a lot of people don't realize what the job of the land commissioner is, to raise revenues. And the way that the land commissioner does that primarily is by the leasing of our state's lands, and especially the mineral rights, to the private sector for oil and gas exploration. And we've done that, and Texas has been very, very blessed in the past because we've had a bountiful resource in oil and in gas. But since 1972, when we hit peak production, those resources have been dwindling. And it has an impact, obviously, on the permanent school fund and the revenues that flow into the permanent school fund. We've seen a reduction in the flow of real value into the permanent school fund since 1984. And I'm going to use 2 years as an example. In 1984, $495 million or so flowed into the permanent school fund. In 2009, I think we received about $297 million into the permanent school fund. Now, if you just compare those two absolute numbers, you get a very warped perception of what's really happening in the permanent school fund. It says, well, it's less than half. The truth of the matter is, if you adjust the $484 million for inflation, $484 million is actually $1.1 billion. And when you compare the value of the money that used to flow into the permanent school fund with the value of the money that's currently flowing into the school fund, you see a diminution of about 67, 68, 69, almost 70%. That's what's been happening since 1984. And the state has now used up most of the oil and gas on its own lands. So therefore, we have to do something drastically in order to make sure that we can create a new revenue stream into the permanent school fund. And that's one of the major reasons why I'm running for the Office of Land Commission. The other reason relates to our bays and estuaries. According to the National Wildlife Federation, five of our seven major bays and estuaries are unhealthy. And the reason for their unhealthiness is because of something that's happening upstream or not happening upstream. And that is, there's been a reduction in the flow of fresh water into our bays and estuaries. Fresh water is the lifeblood of our bays and estuaries. And my opponent has been in office almost 8 years now, and I do not think that he has been a very aggressive advocate for our bays and estuaries. If anything, I think he has been somewhat neglectful of our bays and estuaries. There's a lot that we can do with respect to, first of all, increasing the revenue flow into the permanent school fund, and the revenue and the water flow into our bays and estuaries. And that's what my campaign is all about. How do we go about addressing the shortfall that we're going to experience in the permanent school fund in future years? I look to our submerged lands here in Texas as being a tremendous resource that is not that have not been fully utilized by the state. The state of Texas owns 10.3 miles into the Gulf of Mexico. And there is not one single wind turbine producing one single kilowatt of electricity. Jerry Patterson brags about Texas being first in wind energy. The truth of the matter is that if you compare the state to Indiana and Iowa and other smaller states, that yes, you can literally say that Texas is first in production of wind energy. But the truth of the matter is that whatever wind energy is being produced, it's not being produced on the state's lands, because the state's lands out in West Texas are not in that critical corridor, wind corridor, where most of the development is taking place and where Boone Pickens is placing his wind turbines and developing wind farms. What I propose is that we look again to the Gulf of Mexico as being an appropriate site to locate wind turbines and wind farms. There's a number of reasons. One, the wind turbines would be located very close to major metropolitan areas where there's where we have a great need for energy. Only 10.3 miles out of the Gulf of Mexico. Now, if we ever wanted to develop wind power out in the Gulf of Mexico, and Boone Pickens is trying to do that, you still have the issue of transmission lines. And it's going to cost nearly $1 million per mile to develop the transmission lines to distribute and deliver the electricity that's produced out in West Texas on West Texas farms. So it's going to be a very costly and long-term proposition. The state also has land which is suitable for solar power, which the state isn't using. But again, that's going to be a costlier proposition to develop because of the transmission issues. To me, it makes common sense to develop wind energy and wind farms right here in our very own Gulf of Mexico, where the state would be receiving about $20,000 per year per wind turbine as a royalty. And I'm not using my own figures that I made up. I'm actually using Boone Pickens' own figures with respect to how much we could generate. So it's about 5,000 wind farms, we could be generating $1 billion per year in perpetuity of clean renewable energy. And those $1 billion would be flowing into our permanent school fund, and they would be making up for the reduction in funds since 1984.
You know, it's interesting you talk about this. The United States as a whole is fairly behind the rest of the world when it comes to developing offshore wind farm technology. There's one that's out in off the coast of Massachusetts that's been tied up in litigation for years. One objection to wind farms, as I understand it, is the migratory birds. There was an issue a couple of years ago where the Kennedy Ranch down in Kennedy County wanted to set up wind farms, and they ran into the stiff resistance from the King Ranch. What's, you know, migratory birds, the other issue that people complain about is noise, and for something that's off the coast, there would be issues of, you know, that it wouldn't look good. How do you deal with that? Well, and would you be concerned about there being litigation issues?
Well, my main concern is going to be for birds who are simply following their migratory patterns. They've done consistently for tens of thousands of years, probably migrating from the north down to Central and South America to Mexico. We must be very, very concerned about that. But I've been doing a lot of reading about bird kills, and probably the most significant bird kill experience that's attributable to wind farms is the one in Altamonte, California. We're all familiar with that. Well, let's hope we don't make the same sort of mistake that we put wind turbines in prime nesting areas, as they do in that, in Altamonte, California. We've got to be very, very concerned where we site these wind turbines. Secondly, we have to make sure that we don't make the mistake putting wind turbines that are where the blades are close to the ground. They have to be much higher than they were in Altamonte. Thirdly, and this is something that needs to be explored, we need to make sure that we can remotely stop the blades from revolving during the migratory seasons of these birds. And I think that's probably something that, technologically speaking, we can do fairly easily, whereby we make a concession that we need to protect the birds while they're flying in and around and near these wind turbines. But as far as the aesthetic concerns, I don't know how to deal with that. I don't think anybody likes transmission wires over their property. I don't know that the wind turbines themselves are that observable 10.3 miles out of the Gulf of Mexico. Some of them might actually be closer. But I think that leadership requires that we balance all of these interests. The interest of protecting our birds, the interest in generating funds for our public schools through the Permanent School Fund, and our interest in protecting vistas. And I will come down on the side of what is in the best interest of our school children first, but I will always be very, very concerned about making sure that we do not have bird kills like the experience that we had in Altamonte, California.
Talk for a second about the Permanent School Fund. The State Board of Education recently voted to allocate up to $100 million out of the Permanent School Fund to help charter schools with property acquisition and construction. It's kind of controversial. Some people, including State Representative Scott Hochberg, said that it shouldn't be a function of the Permanent School Fund. Given that the land office has some ownership of the school fund, what's your opinion on that?
Well, the land commissioner serves on the school land board. But I want you to know that I served in the Texas House of Representatives and the Texas Senate in the legislature for 13 years, and I serve on the Education Committee. I am diametrically opposed to the diverting of public school monies for charter schools, even though charter schools have now been, now put this in quotation marks, redefined as public schools. I thought that was a nifty redefinition of charter schools. I think it happened maybe 8 to 10 years ago. How all of a sudden our charter schools also became known as public schools. I think it's very, very important that we not divert funds from our public school system in any way. And although I probably wouldn't have a vote on the issue because it's really a legislative matter, I certainly would, philosophically am opposed to the diverting of funds from the Permanent School Fund to fund our charter schools.
Commissioner Patterson, in recent years, and came up again a few months ago, has advocated selling off the Christmas Mountains State Park to private interests on the grounds that, A, it would be cheaper to maintain. I'm wondering about that. That, A, it would be cheaper for a private interest to maintain, and, B, his concern is that if it was turned over to the national parks, that they wouldn't allow guns on there.
Charles, before I address that issue, let me go back to speak about another anomaly that currently exists with respect to wind power. Back in 2007, the legislature enacted legislation which amended the Texas Economic Development Act, and it created incentives for wind and solar and renewable energy. I don't know if you're familiar with them or your listeners are, but what's interesting to me is that those incentives literally come out of the pockets of our public schools and our general revenues. And here's where those incentives were. And this is for the private sector. Private sector developers can apply with the school districts for a tax abatement. And there, the improvements that they put in the school district, on school district, within the school district's jurisdiction, are abated. And then those school districts can apply to the state to be reimbursed for the amount of the abatement. Well, the reimbursement comes out of general revenues. So we have a system now where we are actually incentivizing private sector development of renewable energy. And that's not a bad thing, except that we've placed our submerged lands on an unlevel playing field in the process. That is, we have sent the incentives out to West Texas, where it's incredibly expensive to deliver the electricity that's produced, rather than looking to the permanent, to the state's submerged lands and developing wind turbines and wind farms on our submerged lands. And it's something that I recently discovered, and it seems to me that what we've done is that we've placed our state lands at a competitive disadvantage with respect to the development of private lands that Boone Pickens is trying to develop out in West Texas. And now I can go into the Christmas mountain situation. But I thought that's something, that's an area in which I want to continue studying and determining whether there isn't a role for our land commissioner to be a more effective and aggressive spokesperson for our state lands, especially our submerged lands, with respect to renewable energy.
All right, so the Christmas
Mountains. Well, that's very interesting because basically Jerry Patterson's reneging on a promise to the Mellon Foundation and the grantors. The grantors gave these pristine Christmas Mountains, state of Texas, for the people's use in perpetuity. And the state had the option under the grant to offer these lands to the National Park Service. And oddly enough, Jerry Patterson did do that. And once he met the letter of the law, not necessarily the spirit of the contract, he went ahead and he called for bids on the Christmas Mountains, and a private developer was interested in the purchase of the land. Well, subsequent to the sale of the land, the grantors, I think, and many others, conservationists throughout not just the state but throughout the country, petitioned the National Park Service to reconsider their decision as to whether their decision was that they didn't want the Christmas Mountains. So the National Park Service reconsidered and contacted Jerry Patterson and let him know that they were in fact interested. And it was at that point when Jerry Patterson started setting up obstacles to the transfer of the Christmas Mountains to the National Park Service. First, it was no hunting. What was it? No guns, no hunting, no way, basically, is the way Jerry Patterson put it. But now the National Park Service has removed its opposition to guns. And the National Park Service permits hunting in several of its national preserves. So that should not be any obstacle for the state to transfer ownership of these properties to the National Park Service and ultimately allow the Christmas Mountains to become part of the Big Bend National Park. There's some real practical reasons why that should happen. One is that the state of Texas faces a $21 billion deficit in the current, in this coming biennium. And yes, we all recognize that the deficits that are facing the national government are larger than they ever have been for a number of reasons that I won't go into. But it seems to me that the National Park Service long term is going to be a better steward of the Christmas Mountains than any private developer or any other public institution that could hold title to the Christmas Mountains. So it makes perfect sense to me that and when I become Texas Land Commissioner, the first thing I'll do, I will ask the National Park Service to accept the Christmas Mountains and make them part of Big Bend National Park.
Land Office has some jurisdiction over beaches as well. Among other things, it sets the vegetation line, which is where you can or cannot build private property in accordance with the Open Beaches Act. In the 2009 legislative session, there was a bill that was passed and ultimately signed by Governor Perry that created an exception to the vegetation line for property on the Bolivar Peninsula after Hurricane Ike. Commissioner Patterson originally came out very forcefully against this and called on Governor Perry to veto it. After Perry did not veto it, kind of backtracked a little bit, said that he would make sure that private property wasn't built past the vegetation line anyway. What's your position on all this?
I'm a former coastal state senator. I represented the Rio Grande Valley, and part of my district was South Padilla. And from my perspective, the beaches don't belong just to the people who reside on South Padilla Island or Galveston or Corpus Christi. They belong to all Texans. And Texas has an interest in protecting those beaches. And, you know, when people build on the coastline, when they build merely on the beaches, they have to be willing to accept the consequences of their decision. The state is not a guarantor of their property, and shouldn't be. So I will be for a very strong, forceful enforcement of our open beaches law, number one, and secondly, the Dunes Protection Act. The dunes on our barrier islands are extremely important for a number of reasons. First of all, they protect the mainland from the onslaught of major hurricanes. But I will do everything that I can as land commissioner to make sure that the spirit of the Open Beaches Act and the Dunes Protection Act live in perpetuity during my tenure as land commissioner.
What's your opinion of the proposed Ike Dike? An extension of an existing seawall that will protect from surge and hurricane.
I think all of these engineering attempts to address beach erosion simply resulted in redistribution of sand. I'm all in favor of beach replenishment programs, but I'm not in favor of artificial barriers to create beaches or to prevent beaches from eroding. I think that's the wrong approach because you have net winners and net losers in the process. I think because the beaches belong to all Texans, and because the communities on the Gulf Coast are big economic engines for the state and are good, well, they do create a good property tax base for school districts, local school districts, but it's important to preserve our beaches. And I would be a very strong advocate of beach replenishment programs, but not artificial barrier programs.
Okay. One other function of the land office is the Veterans Land
Commission. The Veterans Land Board.
Right. You have proposed using that as a way to build a veterans hospital in the valley. Talk to me a little bit about that.
You noticed that. That's,
I do my homework.
Well, Charles, let me tell you. It's a long commute to San Antonio for a veteran to be able to get what is rightfully theirs, which is good treatment in a good veterans hospital. It's been historically unfair, just the way it was historically unfair for students in the Rio Grande Valley who might want to get a master's degree or a doctoral program degree to have to go all the way to San Antonio or to the University of Texas or to a major metropolitan area like Houston in order to get a master's degree. It just wasn't fair. Now, I recognize that veterans hospitals are generally products of federal creation. But I think that the state has an interest in serving those veterans. And I, you know, very honestly, I congratulate Jerry Patterson for being so active in creating out of the Veterans Land Board additional programs to build nursing homes. Well, this would just be an extension of that by creating a facility. Now, we would still need the federal government to come in and staff that facility and provide the other resources that are necessary to actually offer medical treatment to our Valley veterans. But I think it's something that the Valley veterans have been asking for now since my tenure in the Texas Senate. I mean, the last year that I was in the Senate was 1990. So we've gone another 20 years without a veterans hospital, and they've been asking for one for 20 years prior to that. I think it's about time that we redistributed some of the services in the state of Texas has a role to play. And I, the way I put it is, you know, if we build it, we, the state, build it, the federal government will come and provide services.
One other function of the Land Commission, of course, is to be on the Legislative Redistricting Board. How would you like to see that go if you wind up there?
Well, we know that the last time we had redistricting, that every single member of the Legislative Redistricting Board was a Republican. And we came up with some very odd gerrymandering. And we wound up with Roy Doggett representing the Rio Grande Valley. I mean, that's a pretty long drive from Austin to McAllen and La Jolla, Texas. And, you know, obviously Tom DeLay played a very important role in the gerrymandering of our House and Senate and congressional districts. We had two sessions, special sessions, one in which the House members went to Oklahoma, and then Ardmore, and then the Senate broke quorum, and they went out to New Mexico. Well, let's hope that we won't have to do that again. Let's hope that we can elect good candidates for Attorney General like Barbara Radnofsky and me to serve on the veterans, not the veterans, but the Legislative Redistricting Board. Barbara is an excellent attorney. I'm an attorney as well. I sort of started my law practice as a civil rights lawyer out in El Paso. Did that for about 3 years. And did a great deal of class action litigation. I think we'll be able to handle ourselves extremely well with any other person who serves on the Legislative Redistricting Board. You know, it's we're ready to serve. We know what is involved in protecting the one-man, one-vote rule. We want to make sure that Texans are fairly represented and that we recognize interests that need to be represented, you know, in Congress and Senate and the Texas House.
I understand that on this campaign, since neither you nor Commissioner Patterson has a whole lot of campaign money, that you have shared some expenses and shared some trips together.
Well,
I'm a little strange.
Well, let me say, well, you know, I don't know where I was from with respect to the beer, but we actually have traveled together on airplanes, and you know, I'm neglectful if I didn't mention that Jerry's mother passed away today, and we're sorry to hear about that. He's been a gentleman. He has done the right thing with respect to meeting with the media, answering questions, participating in forums with his opponent, unlike Rick Perry. I think Jerry Patterson needs to be commended for putting his record out there and saying, look, this is what I've done, I'm proud of it, or I would do this differently. I think that's what every single voter expects of their public officials, and that is for some sort of openness and accountability in public forums. It underscores what's happening, underscores the rancor that is being experienced in the gubernatorial race between the two gubernatorial candidates, and it's how can I put it? I'm grateful to Jerry for opening himself up to public comment and public debate.
And why should people vote for you when they come down with it on November 2nd?
Well, it has to do with failure of leadership. And I've told Jerry to his face that I don't think he's been a good leader with respect to the Permanent School Fund. I think he should have done more by approaching the legislature and requesting that at least 50% of revenues that flow into the Permanent School Fund, that they be mandated that they come from renewable energy. I think he's failed us with respect to bays and estuaries. I think he should have been a much more forceful ombudsman for an appropriate allocation of fresh water upstream. I think there's a role for the Land Commission to play to make sure that our bays and estuaries are allocated from current unallocated water sources, that the amounts of water that are necessary to make sure that our bays and estuaries stay healthy. Thirdly, I don't think we want to follow in Jerry's direction of putting public properties or properties intended for public use in private hands. Those are my main three disagreements with Jerry. I have minor disagreements about other matters. I want to congratulate him for his efforts on the part of veterans. I think he can do more. And I would do more. I think he's not in support of my proposal for a hospital in the Rio Grande Valley. That said, I'm appreciative of the time that he's taken to debate the issues.
Well, Hector Uribe, thank you very much for speaking to me today.
Thank you, Charles.